It's The Takeaway, and I'm Duarte Geraldino. We round out our hour today with a new film that brings us back in time. First Cow, directed and co-written by Kelly Reichardt, is set in the Oregon Territory in the 1820s. Now, the film approaches that moment in U.S. history differently than conventional Hollywood westerns.
What's sort of front and center in most westerns are a lot of large moments that involve masculine power and revenge, and that masculine power is all kind of goofy in this movie and set in the background. And then we're into these more domestic, small moments with our two protagonists.
The film tells the story of a white cook who travels west with a group of fur trappers. The cook's name is Cookie, and he's played by John Magaro. Now, Cookie is not the typical hyper-masculine character you often see in westerns. He's much more reserved, and it's not until he meets a Chinese immigrant named King Lu that he's able to form a real connection. The migrant is played by Orion Lee. Kelly's movie is based on the 2004 novel The Half-Life, written by her co-screenwriter John Raymond. The film and the book differ in many ways, but both open with a quote from William Blake. "The bird, a nest. The spider, a web. Man, friendship."
You know, it's about friendship and sort of the balance in the natural world. And while it's mostly about this friendship, it does sort of look at this question of capitalism versus the natural world and if those two things can coexist.
Beyond their personal friendship, Cookie and King Lu also become business partners. They steal milk from a wealthy British businessman's cow, yes, a cow, and use it to make donuts. When I sat down with Kelly, she said that beyond telling a gentler story about this time period, she wanted to more accurately reflect the communities living in the West during the early 19th century.
In 1820, in what's now Oregon, you know, yeah, people weren't making the trek across country yet. You know, Cookie did, our main character, and some trappers, but it was very largely people coming by ship from Russia and China. And, you know, and who had been in that area before were the Chinook and the Multnomah tribes had been there for a very long time.
Did you consult with many Native American groups when you were researching this film and how to portray that particular slice of American history?
We did. We sort of worked our way into, there's a beautiful museum in Southern Oregon called the Grand Ronde, and it's a confederation of tribes, and they really have this very intimate, beautiful museum that just opened at the time we started doing our research. And they eventually opened their library to us and connected us with someone that could help us with the language. And April Napier, our costume designer, met through them some women who made the cedar capes that are in the film. And so, and everyone we met had shared their family histories with us and what they had. And then by the end, they were, you know, very sort of keeping us at arm's length at the beginning. And by the end, they, you know, lent us the canoes from out of their museum. So it was really a big thing for us that these new friends we made, to see them show up on location and walk down the mountain carrying this canoe over their head for us. It was pretty great.
Was it a surprise or did you just work it in? I know that you...
We worked it in. Like, John Raymond is always a little bit the diplomat at the beginning of each of our projects. We made a film called Night Moves and it was a little bit hard breaking in with the communities that were, you know, really living off the land and pretty hardcore environmentalist. And a lot of people, they were sort of suspicious of us as filmmakers in the same way that the people at the Grand Ronde would be, because they've just been misrepresented so many times. And so they were reluctant.
On that note of misrepresentation, what do you do differently that you believe fairly represents them?
You know, first of all, we're dealing with a language that the actors had to learn, which is this jargon, the Chinook Wawa. And I'm editing it, and, you know, it's a difficult language, and I'm hoping we're in the ballpark for, you know. So I don't want to say that we've, like, nailed anything. I mean, really, just putting the camera in a position of an observer of where it's not necessarily the first people being observed, but having their point of, just physically having the point of view of, like, the strangeness is actually the white person in the frame. Just even something like that is maybe a bit different. There's a scene in the movie that takes place in the chief factor's house, and the chief factor is sort of like the CEO that comes to run the beaver trade. And there's a scene with him and his wife, who would be a Chinook woman, played by Lily Gladstone, and Gary Farmer is the kind of prominent man who's representing the local tribes. And there's King Lu, who's the Chinese man in our film. And there's Cookie, who's low on the ranks because he's poor. And so there is this, there's this hierarchy that already exists, you know, and that was a really tricky scene of trying to figure out how to get across and not in the dialogue, you know, through shooting where everybody stood as far as like who has the power in this room and where they are in the pecking order. But yeah, there is a, there's already a, you know, there's not an established currency yet. There's all kinds of trade going on, but there is already a hierarchy based on race and wealth.
You've been working in independent cinema for more than two decades now. Has getting financing for your work changed? Is it more difficult now, or is it easier because of your reputation?
It's easier for me now. Yeah, for sure. I mean, we make every film. I feel every time I make a film, it's my last, like, okay, this is really it. No one's going to let us do anything after this.
Why do you feel that way? Wait a minute.
Because it just, I especially felt that way in Meek's Cutoff. Because you're in the desert, you can't really see. We were using these huge bonnets where you could hardly, everyone was supposed to look like this, like a bird almost, and you wouldn't really see the actors' faces. And, you know, you just don't know because telling intimate stories is, it's not like there's a, you know, you just, the climate is very geared towards big and spectacular. But these films, like I have had a very productive decade, and this film, as soon as we, you know, this Scott Rudin's company made the film, and they read the script and said yes in like an hour.
In an hour, you got approval.
So yeah, that's never happened before. So it was really fast and almost like took us by surprise. Like, oh wow, we're making a film right now.
Are you open to possibly going to the big budget world?
That's not really in my, it's just not even, it's not really a goal for me. There's no one really looking over my shoulder as I'm making these films. It's a very go off and we make them. I've been working with the same producers for a decade, and I have a really nice group of people that I work with, and we're a really good team, and I like the adventure, and it's very, you know, it's very livable, and I have a, you know, I teach, and I like teaching.
At Bard College, right?
Yeah, Bard. And so I teach there in the falls, and that's another community that I'm very tied into and keeps me thinking about film in fresh ways that I don't think I would come across somewhere else necessarily. So it's a nice world. It's not, you know, it's maybe not for everybody, but it works for me.
Thank you so much, Kelly.
Thank you. Thanks for talking to me.
Kelly Reichardt is the director and co-writer of First Cow. Her film opens in theaters this Friday.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.